Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
It's that time again, and Owl Post is freshly delivered, and I'm just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, just a joy to be around, the wonderful and fantastic Drea Kaufman.
Hey!
Yay!
I wish everyone could see the little weird dance that went along.
It was good. It was good.
It was real nice, guys.
Was the weird dance because we've been getting a lot of communication recently about Owl Post?
Yeah, it's like a new year, and a lot of people's New Year's resolution is to, like, I don't know, reach out to the podcast that they like, because all of a sudden we're getting a lot of feedback. Either that or people just feel very strongly about Umbridge, but y'all, I want to believe that it's you and me, but it might just be everyone's united hatred of Umbridge.
All of the people. Lifehouse had it right. And no, thank you so much to everybody who has been reaching out to us. I mean, it's been a real joy for Drea and I to have people, talk to us about the show and what they've been liking. And, you know, we got a great tweet a couple of days ago from Adam Conti, and they said, another great episode. Thanks for reading my review on the show. My son, Oliver, really enjoyed hearing it. Don't worry about the adult language, PCF chick, and that's you on Twitter. Everyone likes hearing how much of an a-hole Fudge and Umbridge are in this book, which is totally true because, yes, I'm going to say it, they're just kind of dicks.
So I'm going to start using the Good Place language for things and say she's being a real bench.
Motherfucking shirt, they're awful.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Oh. So I'm going to try to use that in exchange so I can convey my true feelings without causing any parental discord.
I've always liked to say that they're a witch with a capital B, you know? Mm. So, yeah, definitely. We also got a great tweet from Andrew Neal, and they said, just wanted to say thanks for the podcast. I'm currently on book 3 and listening to a chapter and your show as part of my playlist. Loving your breakdowns, and even though I have heard and read the books multiple times, it makes me think about them in a new way, which, you know, it was really nice to hear that because, honestly, that's one of the reasons for doing this show is just that it gives us the opportunity to kind of go through the books and think about them maybe differently, and it's kind of fun that we're helping other people do that too.
Yeah, it's basically the point of why we decided to do this, that and the fact that we just both really love Harry Potter. And I think on some level, we both really like hearing ourselves talk. But but I mean, I'm really glad that it's working out the way that it is and that people are enjoying the in-depth analysis and the differing perspectives. So I was very happy to hear that for sure.
Well, last but not least, this was really cool. We got an email from Jason Wilkinson, and they said that they wanted to congratulate us on our 100th episode. And they have had to catch up and experience the fastest pregnancy. Haha, they said.
I wish I could say I feel the same.
Drea does not feel that way. They loved the discussion and the analysis and loving even more now that you're both referring to past books and relating to what we are reading now. And they said, thank you. Keep it up. And they hope that we have another giveaway, which I think that this year we will probably do another giveaway for a review contest over there on Apple Podcasts and iTunes, which I really thank you so much there, Jason, for leading me into just a fantastic segue to say, yes, it is the new year and we have been getting some great reviews. We mentioned those last week. And we would like to encourage people to continue to give us those star rating reviews on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, help people find the show, make it more popular. And gosh, you guys tweeting and talking about the show also help it make more popular. So thank you so much. You can find us all over the place too. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty. You can also find us on Twitter at @joinnerdparty. Maybe you want to check out the website where you can see everything that we're doing Nerd Party-wise, which a great place to go is thenerdparty.com. And maybe, like Jason, you would like to send us an email. You can do that by going over to thenerdparty.com/contact, choose a show, choose Owlpost, and then that will come to us and we'll be able to converse with you that way, read out your thoughts on the show, as well as, you know, maybe you have some things you want to talk about maybe more privately. So that's a great place to be able to do that. But whew, goodness, Dre, I felt like we had a lot to talk about, and we're getting to chapter 9, which is the woes of Miss Weasley. And I feel like there are a million different things that happen in this chapter.
It really is a pretty comprehensive chapter. I feel like she spent a lot of time in the previous chapters being very fixated on kind of a singular thing that's happening, you know, culminating some of the events that have already happened and setting the stage for the future with one sort of thing. And now I feel like she's playing catch up a little bit and trying to cover more of what she's the story she's trying to weave here together. So.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we pick right back up where we left off, and I felt quite, I was like right there with Harry in the awkwardness of the situation. You know, the trial's done, he's been acquitted, but then like Dumbledore immediately swoops out, so he doesn't even say anything, and Harry's just kind of like, can I go? Am I? So he just like walks out the door and nobody stops him. So
like, okay,
which I think is great. And you know, Mr. Weasley, is so excited as he comes out the door. And then I thought this was interesting, and it's something that we talked about last time, but Mr. Weasley confirms it, saying that he was tried by an entirely full court. Like this is, they made a huge deal of this. You know, Fudge had made a huge deal of this, and I think it rightly goes to what we were talking about last week, which is that Fudge really wanted the opportunity, I think, to nail Harry here, and to do it with full court press, basically. You know, he wanted the conviction, he wanted it to be something where they could make a big deal out of it. And now, you know, everybody's kind of slinking out of the room because, you know, Fudge and Umbridge, they didn't get what they wanted. But speaking of Umbridge, she keeps kind of like sizing Harry up strangely. And Harry feels very awkward about this, you know, toad-like witch staring at him. And I get really bad vibes from her. And I don't think she's going to be a good character in this book.
And I don't think she's going to go away.
No, I don't think she's either. But the other really sad thing, too, is we get Percy just completely ignoring his father as he walks out of the room, which it just goes back and shows you and reinforces this really... this awful rift that has happened in the Weasley household.
Before we move on, I do just want to kind of point out that it is really interesting how much Fudge wants to sort of sensationalize what's happened with Harry and really, like you kind of mentioned, make a big splash with it. And how one of the things we see happen as we progress through this chapter is the fact that not only did he not get to make a big sensational splash, it literally never comes up in the news at all either way. Like there was a full wizarding trial and we hear nothing about it. So it's just really interesting how that sort of works.
Yeah, I think you're just right to call that out. That's exactly what he wanted and he doesn't get it. And then I think we see the way in which the Daily Prophet maybe is working hand in hand with the government here. And it is not something that you hear anything about because, you know, obviously if Harry had been, found guilty, we would immediately have probably seen this all over the Wizarding News, you know. Wizarding Wireless would have picked it up. You would have had, it running in the evening edition of the Daily Prophet, that kind of thing. It would have been everywhere. But we don't get any indication that we hear anything about this anywhere, which is kind of interesting because I think it really shows the political climate that we're in at this moment.
Right. And before we left the ministry and headed back to the headquarters to kind of be confronted with this whole Weasley scenario, ran into an interesting and familiar character at the ministry, conversing with Fudge, we see that it's Lucius Malfoy, who we now know to be a Death Eater and a follower of Lord Voldemort, conversing with Cornelius Fudge, which just, you know, it doesn't give you much more faith in the government that's established when you know they're conversing with someone who has ulterior motives, you know, whether the ministry knows or believes his ties. We know for a fact that they would not be in everyone's best interests.
You know, I really like that you called that out, because I do think that this again goes to show the absolute kind of corruption in the wizarding government at the moment. And I think one of the things that Rowling is doing a very good job of is showing how this kind of cronyism in government works. You know, we hear, Mr. Weasley talk about how Lucius has given so much money to different people. And basically he's buying influence and friends, you know, to get him what he wants then later on. And I think we see that playing out here. And yes, I love the way that this is done, because it just gives us a real sense of unease then. Okay, so the person who's running the government is not only all over, you know, trying to get rid of people like Dumbledore and Harry Potter and discount them, but they are actively in the confidence and allowing, you know, people like Lucius Malfoy, who we know to be Death Eaters now, to influence them. And, you know, obviously Fudge is denying that kind of relationship that Lucius would have with Voldemort, because he's denying that Voldemort's back. But we see the danger here. And I think she does such a great job of setting up a lot of unease as we leave the ministry in this chapter. Harry might be excited that, you know, finally realizing that he is going to go back to Hogwarts, but realizing that this is the placement of the government and the people that are in charge of it, it does not, you know, do well to engender confidence in anyone reading this book at all.
Right. And I feel like for Harry, it sort of reminds him that, yeah, he is cleared of all charges, but by no means is he like in the clear. Right. Like they managed through this crisis, but I feel like it gives him that looming feeling that this is not going to be the last time he has to deal with something along the lines of what he dealt with, and that it's not going to be fair. Like going forward, they're not going to be fighting fair, and it's not going to be something where he, you know, nothing's going to work the way that it should, you know, altruistically work.
Well, and, you know, I don't know. I was just really struck in this chapter that this whole beginning, you know, I felt like to me it threw a cloud over the rest of the chapter, which a lot of, you know, good things happen here, you know, and a lot of happy things kind of happen here. But there does seem to be this overarching, you know, even in this chapter too, is as happy as Harry can be throughout it, there is always something to remind him that things are actually kind of bleak, you know? So there's this sense of where there's never too much joy, because there's always something to remind us that there are storm clouds on the horizon, and they just keep building. And the majority of people out there are saying, you know what? No, we don't believe there are any storm clouds out there, you know? it's
right.
I was, you know, just in Texas for the holidays, and you know, and you live in Arizona too, and so it's very similar in the sense that if there's a storm front on the horizon, you can clearly see it. It's coming, you know? And it would be like somebody standing on the plains of Texas looking at the storm front, those big billowing huge thunderheads, and being like, nope, nope, not going to rain. We're going to be fine. Everybody get in the pool. You know, like that's exactly kind of what Fudge is doing here. And I think it's super scary. I do have to say, though, that it's fascinating that and wonderful when we do get back to the house. And I do love, real quickly, because I forgot this, I just almost forgot to mention it. I love that Harry, he takes his money bag and he pours out the whole thing, all everything that he has into the fountain. And I thought, man, that's it just really shows Harry Potter's character. But I also loved, as he's looking at the statue, how ridiculous he thinks it is. Like, that everything about it looks fake. And then he thinks to himself, except for the fact of the house elf's, like, attitude of creepy, like, servanthood. Like, the fact that they just seem to adore their master, like, but that everything else about it just seems so false. And I love that little tiny bit, because it showed that Harry sees through the BS. And I thought that was really cool.
And part of that, I think, is just the experience he's had, right? And the perspective he brings is much different. It comes from much more of a place of awareness and understanding. And to me, that really does show, too, that he has this sort of global perspective as of to how things operate. And that, you know, he's looking at things from a larger level and on different ways than a lot of people can do. So it's really great that even at his sort of youthful age, he can see that. Now, whether he'll maintain that perspective as we go through this book, you know, he is a teenager after all. But being able to have that perspective and immediately identify that it doesn't seem to be correct, knowing that however many other people thought it was correct enough to put up in the middle of their government, you know, it kind of gives that interesting perspective of how and gives you an idea of how he really thinks about the world.
It's so great to, like I was saying before, I rudely interrupted myself, that when we get back, everybody is so relieved. Harry's like, man, everybody seems so relieved, considering that you all knew I was going to get off. And it does really show how worried everybody is. But I love, like, the feeling of it all. Like, Fred and George and Ginny are, like, kind of doing a war dance chant around the house. He got off. Like, you're just, like, in the background, you know. Not only that, but I just kind of love that, that whole little thing with those three. Like, you really, Ginny is really coming into her own in this book. Like, she is not shy around Harry at all anymore. She's truly become a full-on character, and I really enjoy seeing that in those moments where we're getting a moment here in this chapter that's already had some kind of, we've got some relief, but there's some bleakness in there. All of that together, this part kind of like, it feels good to be back and to have people have something to celebrate.
Right. Especially because the chapter starts to get a little bleak again when they kind of start to see more and more of what's happening around this headquarters house, which is just sort of doom and gloom in its own, by very definition of it being, you know, Sirius's family home.
Well, and, you know, I thought it was interesting that We get some glimpses in here, and we're going to jump around the chapter for just a second, because we get some glimpses in here of things, Harry talking about certain things and it really hurting his scar. And one of the moments here is when he's talking about how Dumbledore really swung the trial for him and really helped him out, and how he's really looking out for him, and that his scar really starts to hurt badly. And then, of course, it also happens at the very end of the chapter where Harry is just so frustrated with some things that have been happening, and his scar is also burning in his skull at that moment. And I feel one of the things is that I felt really bad for him, because Harry is already having a very tough year, but to add this, like, physical, kind of like Apostle Paul in the Bible, like this thorn in the flesh that he cannot get rid of, this thing that just keeps, you know, digging into him, and literally that scar, you know, it burns. And I just felt like, goodness, I feel like there's really something going on here. And of course we know there's something really going on, but she really is.
Spoiler alert, yeah, there's really something going on, guys.
She really is building towards something, which I think is going to be very interesting to see why it is that Harry's scar is bothering him so much. And maybe it's connection to you know, why he is possibly so irritable and everything that's going on there. So I think, you know, it was again, this chapter is one that really is building a lot of she's placing a lot more puzzle pieces out there. You know, not necessarily placing them anywhere just yet, but there are a lot of things out there that are going to be built on to make a full picture once we get to the end.
I always like to remind myself as I go through, especially the early chapters of a book, that she never does anything by happenstance. Like everything kind of has a purpose and a reason, or most things have a purpose and a reason. So I generally try to remind myself of that as I read the earlier chapters, to pay attention to some of those smaller details or those things that like, oh, whatever, okay. Because she doesn't do those for just no reason. I feel like everything you kind of just described falls into that little like mind category for me. Like, oh, yep, got to check that one off. Got to remember that. I kind of start making a little list of things in my head to go back and revisit near the end of a chapter, or when I see, okay, so what's left now from the end of this book that might carry on, or what have we determined we just legitimately don't have anything to do with? And I feel like all of that kind of falls into that category for me. So they're good observations, and I make little mental notes of them as I read.
You know, it's almost as if people should remember that for the Fantastic Beasts series. Anyway, you know, what I also thought was very interesting here is that Sirius kind of seems to fall into more of a depression as we move through things, and he's trying to put up a good face, but we have this conversation between Ron, Harry, and Hermione about how, you know, the idea of, you know, maybe he really thought that you wouldn't get off and then you'd both be outcast together. And Hermione's like, you know, I think maybe there's something to the fact that, you know, he might see, you know, a little bit more of James and you and have trouble kind of keeping them, apart. And the fact that, you know, Harry's like, what, you think he's crazy? And Hermione just says something so smart. And I think it really plays into the character. And I think we mentioned this maybe a few episodes back, but that Sirius has been somebody who's been lonely for a very long time. You know, he lost his best friends, and then he was in Azkaban for the longest time, and then he had been on the run. And, you know, yes, he has a much better life than he had, but yet he has still been somebody who has spent most of his adult life very lonely and isolated. And, you know, I just appreciate that Hermione helps us remember that, and the psychological damage that does cause. I think she does a good job to remind us of that, you know, Sirius probably isn't all right in the head, really. He is probably somebody who is very depressed, and could probably use some counseling, you know, to work through some of the issues that he has. And yet he doesn't have that. And he isn't seeking out that kind of help. And it's not something that's necessarily, it doesn't even really seem to be a part of the wizarding world necessarily. So I thought that was a really important thing to point out, because I think many times in life, we can maybe do the same thing as Sirius, where we want to pretend like everything is okay and everything is not okay. And it's okay for things to not be okay, but we need to be honest about it. And Sirius isn't doing that here. And I think it's definitely hurting him to not just be honest about the fact of how he is truly feeling.
And part of him maybe can't even understand how he's truly feeling, right? He has suffered some pretty traumatic situations, only to find himself in a relatively intense and continuingly traumatic situation. And, you know, it's also difficult sometimes to understand what you're feeling, even enough to have the self-awareness to say, like, I'm not okay. Like, I'm not okay. So I think she loves to use her characters to talk, and the situations to speak to different mental illnesses. And I feel like here she's talking a little bit about PTSD and how that can affect someone, and how, you know, because believe it or not, he's definitely suffering from something of that effect. and you know, that people don't know how to deal with that, and people don't know both themselves and their loved ones. So I feel like there's definitely an issue of that here. You know, he is kind of a soldier in this war and has been before and was a casualty. So, not literally a casualty, but you know what I mean? His mental health was the casualty. So I agree. I don't even think he knows how to get the help he needs, because he probably doesn't even realize he needs the help. So it's a pretty intense, and it's tough to be a teenager dealing with something like that. If anyone's ever had toxic parents or just loved ones that are suffering from something like that, it's really draining and taxing on you and yourself. And there's a certain amount of guilt that goes along with being happy when they're not, and seeing the impact of your happiness on them. You know, Harry experiences that. You know, he's happy to be going back to Hogwarts, and he doesn't want to talk about it or rub it in Sirius's face, but Sirius is a very important person to him, and he, you know, probably should be able to talk about that. But just based on where Sirius is at, he can't do that without kind of being cruel. So it's just really an interesting, another form of mental illness that she's addressing and kind of painting that picture to show here in this chapter. And so it'll be really interesting to see how Sirius sort of develops that throughout the rest of this book and how they learn to sort of deal with it.
I love that there's this great moment of humor where, you know, they're sitting around having this conversation and Miss Weasley's like, come on, we got more to do cleaning wise. And Ron's like, I feel like a house elf. And then Hermione just launches into, oh, now you know how it feels like. And maybe you'll, you know, want to be a, you know, better supporter of Spew and all these things. And I just love Ron under his breath being like, I'll support you to shut you up about Spew. Just awesome. I mean, just classic. And then I thought what was really interesting too is that, you know, at the beginning of the book, Harry was very frustrated because nobody's talking to him, and he, you know, gets to the Order of the Phoenix's headquarters, and he's yelling at Ron and Hermione about how awesome they've had it. And Harry realizes, you know, living at the headquarters isn't all that awesome, because they don't really get to know anything, you know, that the members pass through, you know, a lot of times. And yes, they may hang out with them every once in a while, but they're not learning any information because they're not allowing the kids to be a part of any of this. And, you know, they're definitely trying to, you know, the Mrs. Weasley is much more in tune with the fact that they've been using extendable ears. And so, you know, we have this situation where Harry's like, yeah, this isn't as great as I thought it was going to be. And I just thought that was really interesting for him to kind of realize, maybe in the back of his mind, you know, kind of retroactively, maybe I was a little bit harsh on Ron and Hermione at that point, because, yeah, this isn't as great as I actually thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, now he kind of gets why they weren't making a big deal when he got there. You know, he more just didn't want to be alone, I think, or isolated out in Privet Drive, so... he kind of realizes it's pretty anticlimactic there. He gets to see people come and go, doesn't really get to learn anything. He kind of knows what it's like now. And I think he kind of can understand what Sirius is doing too. Mm-hmm. You know, Sirius gets more information, but can't do anything about it. Yep. Harry can at least go out of the house if he needed to. And you know, he'll get to. So the interesting thing is while they're here, they get their book list for the year. That they're, you know, the book list arrived, and it came pretty late this year, which was surprising. And there's a book on there called Defensive Magical Theory for their defense against the dark arts. And they realize they've found a new teacher for that class, but nobody knows anything about it or who it is. So here's where we learn that there's this belief that the job is basically cursed. They say one, you know, it's not surprising considering what happened to the last teachers they've had the last 4 years. One was fired, one was killed, one's memory was gone, and one was locked away in a trunk for 9 months. So, you know, we're starting to see that maybe this job is kind of jinxed, and has sort of a bad feeling about it. So they have a hard time finding a teacher. So something else happens when they get their book lists, which is kind of amazing. We learn that, no surprise, Hermione is going to be the girls' prefect for Gryffindor for their year. Shocker. I know, everyone's shocked. everyone's like, yeah, hey, congratulations. That's great. But what really is shocking is that the male prefect is Ron, which nobody saw coming. Came completely out of left field. Even Ron was like, are we sure this was in the right package and it's not meant for Harry? You know, and Harry kind of struggles. He's really excited for Ron, but there's a part of him that sort of thought maybe it should have been him, or why not him? Why Ron and not him? It's sort of the first time where Ron is in the spotlight and Harry's not. And Harry's not really sure what to do about it. You know, he's happy for Ron, but he's kind of struggling with the selfish side of that too.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I thought was really interesting because, you know, Harry does have to really kind of struggle through this. And I think we see here, you know, I wonder if this is specific, that Rowling maybe saw people kind of almost disrespecting Ron in fandom at this point, and putting Ron in the forefront, you know, here, of having him get something that, you know, everybody thought would go to Harry, but it's given to Ron. And yes, there are reasons for this, and we'll talk about them way later in the book as to why Dumbledore made this choice. But at the same time, I think what it does for Harry is it does have to make him question himself in the sense of, am I really like a Malfoy where I think myself better than my best friend? Like that I'm that kind of elitist, that I'm that one of those kind of people? And he has to process this, you know, and he has to realize that, you know, am I also going to treat my best friend in a way that he doesn't get to enjoy this thing? Or am I going to try and take that away from him because I'm upset in some way that it wasn't me? And I like what I really liked is that there is literally a conversation going on in Harry's head where he's thinking through these things. And I think the fact that Harry's actually thinking them shows a lot of maturity, because most kids would just immediately react and be jealous and frustrated and lash out in some way or act unbecoming towards their friend, whereas Harry doesn't do that. He really sits down and has a conversation with himself. Okay, how am I going to deal with this? And what does that even say about me and how I deal with it? Because if I handle it this way, it makes me like Malfoy, basically. If I handle it this way, okay, that's the kind of the person that I want to be. And also kind of struggling with the fact that, like you said, he's not chosen in this point. And this is kind of the first time that Ron has really been chosen over him for anything. And, you know, I think that's a good thing too, because it's giving Harry the opportunity to grow and to learn to accept that he is not the center of the wizarding universe.
I feel like it's kind of a stark contrast to how Ron reacted last year in the Triwizard Tournament, right? He had an immediate reaction and it caused a rift in their friendship for a while. And I feel like there's a part of Harry that remembers that and knows how that didn't work out last time and is like, I'm gonna handle this differently, right? I'm not gonna let this cause a rift in our friendship over something like this. I also find the conversation he's having in his head is very much so sort of like with two voices, right? It's like one voice sort of edging him on, like, you're so much better, you're so, you know, that sort of thing. And then there's the other voice that's like, wait, is that true? And does that matter? And is that important right now? So he's having a conversation with himself, but it's almost like he's talking to two different people when he's doing it. Like he's talking to somebody else, but in his head, which
Maybe
is a really
got a
interesting
shoulder
kind
angel
of,
and a shoulder devil, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
just like it's kind of, what the Emperor's New Groove. He's just trying yeah. to lead you down the path of righteousness. I'm going to lead you down the path that rocks.
I love that movie. But it's going to be interesting. I think it's kind of significant as we proceed and learn more in this book about what's actually going on. That's another one of those like memory bank things that I file away, because it will prove to be more significant than just like a conversation. And so I do find it really encouraging that he's sort of fighting himself, if you will, fighting his own impulses and fighting, you know, these thought processes. And that, you know, that's really what makes him different than, say, Malfoy or you know, someone else. And I do love that they do have a little party for the prefects at dinner for Ron and Hermione. I love that Mrs. Weasley makes a big deal out about this and really loves Ron. And I think it's just so fantastic. And I love seeing Ron get some of the, you know, some of the glory. And I love that this moment actually allows Sirius and Harry to bond a little bit. We feel like a little bit of a wedge has been driven between them, and so, someone asks Sirius, I believe it's Harry, were you a prefect for your class? And he was like, oh, no, like no one would make me a prefect. Like that was a bad idea. Then it kind of makes Harry feel better, right? Like he thinks of Sirius as this real cool, popular person, but hey, he wasn't a prefect. So I'm okay with that. You know, it's okay to not be a prefect. So,
well, and then we learned that his dad wasn't one either. And so that really does make him feel better. And that it was right. Lupin who was actually the prefect, because I think he says Dumbledore Lupin's thought I might be able to rein them in a little bit, and that didn't really work. But so yeah, he really has this, I think, it feels like he has like a couple of hours where things feel really good, because he realizes, hey, if my dad wasn't a prefect, that's fine. You know, it gives him that ability to feel like, because I think he felt like for a little while that he had almost let people down too. Like, but I've done all these things, and like, why wouldn't I be chosen? Have I let somebody down? Have I made somebody upset? You know, like, and to realize that it's okay to not be a prefect because his father wasn't one either really frees him for a little while of that kind of, feeling as though there's been any kind of, like, he's some kind of disappointment because he's not a prefect, but that doesn't last very long, frustratingly enough. Because we have this moment where Kingsley Sackbolt is talking to Lupin, and he has this moment of saying that, I wonder why, Dumbledore didn't make Potter prefect, and Lupin says, I'm pretty sure he has his good reasons, and Kingsley saying, well, I thought it would have shown confidence in Harry, and that's what I would have done, especially with the Daily Prophet, blah, blah, blah. And Harry just, it's that thing that kind of turns it back into, oh man, I must have done something, or I must not be good enough to be a it kind of gives him that kind of angry, frustrated feeling again, which this chapter is this kind of up and down for Harry. It's like this emotional roller coaster that he's on throughout this entire chapter. And I feel really bad for him because there doesn't seem to be a way for him to kind of get off of it.
Right. Every time he kind of gets some reprieve, he kind of gets pulled right back to it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, and I thought this was something really interesting because we were talking about the kerfuffle that's going on with the Weasley family, and the fact that, Percy's being a huge turd. And we get here Harry having a conversation with Bundungus Fletcher and the twins about them getting some Tectacula seeds from him, and Harry kind of realizing, oh man, like, I funded them, and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley don't know. What if I cause a whole nother rift in the Weasley family by that moment? Like, by being the...
What if I cause a Percy-level incident?
Yes. And I thought that was really interesting because, again, I think it's really good of Harry to be thinking like this, right? Like, I think the fact that Harry's kind of thinking in a more adult sense of like realizing the consequences of your actions can definitely have unintended consequences. I was really impressed to see him kind of think in this manner. And the fact that he's thinking more broadly, like, well, look what happened with Percy and his parents. I don't want to be the cause of that happening with, Fred and George and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley. And it kind of makes him very uneasy, which I just really appreciated again about Harry. I think it shows a lot of maturity.
Yep. Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I totally. It's definitely a chapter of Harry's maturity being displayed. So,
well, we finally deal with that Bogart that's been in the upstairs desk, and Moody takes a look with a special eye and says, "Yes, that's what it is." And it was This is a really sad part of the chapter as Miss Weasley is trying to take care of it, and Harry kind of, he walks past the room and he hears sobbing, and then he sees like Ron's body on the ground, but he realizes it can't be Ron, and then she keeps trying to get rid of it, and it keeps turning to other people and their family, and Lupin finally comes rushing in and takes care of it, and she is just beside herself. But we, I think the thing that I really loved about this is I think Rowling does a wonderful job of driving home the fear that Molly lives with every day with her family and the danger that they are all in with Voldemort coming back. And I think just by being with the Weasley family here, we get this moment of seeing just how bad this could all go. And then not only that, but, you know, of course, Molly's all worried about the fact of what happens if something happens to us, and who's going to take care of, you know, Ron and Ginny, and who's going to take care of, you know, if the fact that what if we never get to make up with Percy? What if the last words we ever said were the mean things that were said, you know, months ago? And you end up with all of this anguish that finally comes out. And I really appreciate her doing this in this book, because I think it shows us the severity of the situation that we're in the Wizarding world and the stakes. Like, these are the stakes. It is friends and family and the rest of the world having this experience as well. And I think she does a great job in this little moment to show us just how badly things could go.
It also sort of paints, you know, it makes Mrs. Weasley, it explains a little bit, right? The last chapter, the chapter before, her and Sirius really got into it. And she had a really strong reaction about sharing the information about the Order of the Phoenix with the kids, right? From this idea that she's protecting them. And yeah, you get that. Okay, yeah, she's protecting them, blah, blah, blah. But really seeing her have this total breakdown, you feel for what she's trying to hold on to, right? And you get this, maybe the strong overreaction that she had is now sort of explained. It's backed by this ultimate fear. And it's not just like control and her trying to be a mom. Like, she's genuinely afraid. And so she's trying very strongly to hold on to anything she can to give her that sort of support and that sort of, you know, reassurance, like something that she can feel slightly good about. So I think that's kind of where it's really nice to see that and have it. I think everyone has to have that tipping point and that breaking moment before they can sort of figure out how to cope with it and make the best of it. And it's nice to see her break and share and feel and experience and then be able to figure out how to move past it and through it. So, I think it's a really powerful moment, especially since Mrs. Weasley's always been such a strong, powerful character.
Well, and I think the thing that I love about this, at the very end of the chapter, we get, you know, as Harry's going to bed and he's having trouble with his scar, he's also thinking to himself how extraordinary it is that, you know, an hour ago he was worried about a joke shop and who got a prefect's badge. And this moment helps put into perspective for Harry exactly what we were just saying. It is perspective of what could happen, right? You know, and the stakes. Like, I think in this moment, Rowling legitimately throws down the gauntlet, showing us what the stakes of this series are. And, you know, as we've mentioned many a times, for Rowling, this is a series about death. And we're faced with the thought of all these deaths could happen. I think, you know, it does a great job of giving us that moment to take pause and say, oh man, we really don't know at this point who's going to live and who's going to die. And I think that makes it really exciting for the rest of the book and the rest of the series. And she's, this chapter does such a great job of setting up so many things that are going to happen throughout the rest of this book and through the rest of the series. So, you know, as we often say, well done, J.K. Rowling.
For sure. Definitely. It's a very comprehensive chapter.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm so excited to dive into the next chapter, chapter 10, Luna Lovegood. We're going to finally meet a beloved character here in this series, and I can't wait to do that. But Drea, you know, as people have been doing, if they want to catch up with you and talk to you on social media about anything Owl Post or Harry Potter wise, where can they find you?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you could find me on all the different social media platforms like Twitter or Instagram, Tumblr, or Letterboxd under MattRushing02. I'm here on the network. I do a show called Aggressive Negotiations. And I do that with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week, which is a lot of fun. You can also find me over on the Trek FM network doing a couple of shows. One is called The Orb. That's about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then I do a great show called The 602 Club with my good friend Christy, who is now the co-host over there. And that's where we talk about all the fandoms we love. So make sure you check that out. We talk about Harry Potter over there, or maybe Star Wars or Marvel or DC, or just a myriad of different types of genre shows or movies. And then last but not least, I do a show called Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney. We'll be back for the new year. And that's where we talk about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.